and so on, pervaded with spirit. Because you could easily get these spirits angry at you. And if you didn't behave yourself and do things correctly, the god of the mountain or the goddess of the river or and so on could get angry at you and make your life really, really miserable. Today, I think we're much more worried about what we are going to do to nature and thus indirectly to ourselves. And I think with very, very good reason. I think we do stand a chance of destroying nature and thus ourselves. But here, in these early periods, life was complicated. It wasn't all that simple, actually. It wasn't all the picture we have of the golden age in the past when everyone lived in this kind of sublime harmony with nature. Because the gods and goddesses, the spirits, could get angry at you. And if you didn't propitiate them appropriately, if you didn't go through the rituals rightly, you could be in some real trouble. That sets the stage, I believe, for something profoundly important that happened in Western culture particularly. I think it is in some ways unique to the West. And that was at two different points in the history of Western culture, we demythologized or desacralized nature. The first, actually they happened in some ways roughly at the same time, but I'll mention first that among the Greek philosophers, the so-called Ionian philosophers, they began to speculate about whether or not behind everything there was something other than spirit and gods and goddesses. And they began to talk in terms of earth, air, fire, and water. They began to talk in terms of atoms, as some tiniest unit of nature. They began to look for what we would think of as more scientific causes, more natural causes, as over against the supernatural causes of what makes things work. The earlier explanations were almost entirely along the lines, well, the gods and goddesses, the spirit of the woods and the river and so on, that's what make things work, and you've got to keep on good terms with them. And it was a nuisance, to say the least, as I said, because they could get angry at you. The early Greek philosophers framed the question differently. Is it possible? Is it not possible? And then they began to argue that it was, that there were natural causes behind these diverse phenomena. And I think you have there the beginnings of what eventually becomes modern experimental science. And if you go on then to Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, particularly Aristotle, you get some very high-powered thinking that begins to look like the way we today think about nature. Probably, I think there's fairly good reason to believe that had the Greeks had a different understanding of time, they might have gone on very quickly towards the development of modern science. We don't know. That's just speculation. But the Greeks tended to embrace a cyclical view of time, that everything sort of repeats itself like a great wheel turning around. There were different accounts. In one account, this was maybe about 25,000 years that the wheel turned full circle, and other cases more quickly. And there was a strong strain in Greek thinking from Platonism that what is ultimately real is not the flux and flow and change of historical reality, our physical, somatic, historical existence. What was ultimately real were the eternal ideas or forms, and historical existence was but a shadowy copy of these eternal forms or ideas or concepts. And so this tended to give the Greeks a certain suspicion, or many of the Greeks, towards life in this world. And their concept of time did not lend itself to what we think of as modern experimental science, which is a more linear rather than cyclical view of time. Time has a beginning, it passes on towards some culmination. Today we talk in terms of the Big Bang, and we talk in terms of possibly the cosmos coming back in on itself towards the state of the Big Bang, or expanding indefinitely. We have different views. But the Greeks lacked that concept of time. But it's very, very significant that they asked these questions in a fundamentally different way. Not what are the spirits, what are the gods, goddesses, divine, supernatural powers, but could we begin to explain the world in natural terms? As I said, earth, air, fire, and water were some of the ones they began to talk about, and so on. A huge change, a paradigm shift in human thinking that had great consequences. Now, interestingly, this a similar change, not the same change by any means, but an analogous change took place in ancient Israel. The ancient Israelites, and I use the term Israelite or Hebrews because the terms Jew and Judaism only come into the literature in about the 6th century before Christ, during the time of the Babylonian exile. The term, they did not use these terms of themselves before that. But among the ancient Hebrews, you began to get a kind of demythologizing of the gods and goddesses of the surrounding culture. You see this, for instance, in the sheet I passed out on Tuesday in Genesis. There is good reason to believe that Genesis 1, especially, represents a kind of demythologizing of ancient Babylonian creation story. And perhaps with some input from other cultures too. So that instead of the gods, Marduk and others, warring among themselves, and instead of the world being the result of these conflicts and so on among the ancient divinities, the Hebrews begin to think in terms of one God. One God who is transcendent to the world and who creates all that we see around us. And this also then has some very, very interesting implications. It unleashes a kind of new social dynamic. It makes it possible within this framework to begin to ask questions, not first of all about the nature of the physical material world, as the Ionian Greek philosophers did, but about the nature of social reality. The Jews, or the ancient Hebrews, were in a position now to begin to ask new questions about justice. What does it mean that we... how should we treat the orphans, the widows, the resident aliens, and what about slaves, and so on? Because they came to believe that there was one God who was transcendent to everything else, and indeed the creator of the world, and that this God was very concerned about human relations and questions of justice, and so on. Let me just take one example from the Jewish scriptures, from 2 Samuel 11, the story that's sometimes referred to as the story of David and Bathsheba, because it very nicely illustrates how this dynamic worked itself out. David was king of Israel. And his army commander Joab was off in the field fighting against the Ammonites, besieging the city of Rabbah. And as the battle went on, it waxed and waned some. In the meantime, back in Jerusalem, David was there as king. He did not join the troops in this battle. As the story goes, he was one day walking on the roof of the palace, and he looks out from the roof of the palace, and he sees Bathsheba bathing in the garden, and he sees that she's very fair, and he desires her, and sends his servants to bring her to the palace, and he has sexual relations with her. Now, the problem was that her husband was off in, even though he was a resident alien, he was a Hittite from the ancient empire of the Hittites, he was off fighting with Joab, and here the king is sporting with his wife back in Jerusalem. The problem gets worse because after a couple months, it's found out that she's pregnant. She's expecting a child. And this presents something of a problem for King David. So he thinks about it and sends a messenger off to the battlefront and to Joab and says, why don't you give Uriah a little vacation? He's been brave and has been fighting hard. Why don't you give him a furlough for a time? So Uriah comes back to Jerusalem, and of course it was the king's hope that he would have sexual relations with his wife, not keep too close account of the time, and that he would think that the child was his own. But Uriah didn't do that because part of the Jewish code, the Hebrew code at this time, they had some regulations concerning how warfare was to be conducted, and one of the regulations was that for a time before the battle and during the battle and for a given time afterwards, you didn't have sex. Not so much, in fact, I think not at all, because they thought of sex as impure. The arguments here are much more complicated. But at any rate, Uriah doesn't go see Bathsheba. He just stays at the palace. And David's getting a little nervous. The king is getting a little nervous, and he urges him. He says, you ought to see your wife, you know. You really ought to. And he says, no, I can't do this. That's against the code of warfare. And so David is really, he doesn't quite know what to do at this point. He thinks about it some more and then decides to send a sealed message with Uriah back to Joab the commander. And the message basically says, get Uriah up in the very forefront of the fighting, and then at a prearranged signal, have all the supporting troops suddenly pull back. It's not a very nice arrangement. And of course, Uriah's killed. Now, in many of the ancient empires at this time, the story either would have ended there or probably wouldn't have even gone that far because the king had enormous power over subjects. But it didn't end there in Israel, because sometime after this, another figure enters the story, Nathan, who was a prophet in Israel, and he comes up to see the king. They knew each other. And he says, King David, I've got a problem, and I need your advice on this. And the king says, okay, what's going on? And Nathan says, well, there are these citizens here that live right near Jerusalem, and they're very poor, and they had just one little ewe lamb, and the kids loved this little ewe lamb. They used to let it come in the house, and it was almost like part of the family. And these poor people had a rich neighbor who had a whole flock of sheep and lambs. He had some guests come, and instead of taking one of his own lambs to feed to the guests, he stole this lamb from these poor people
slaughtered it and served it to his guests. And Nathan says, what should we do? You know, what should we do about this? And the king was very angry. And he said, this is awful. This kind of thing should not happen in Israel. He said, make him pay back at least fourfold for what he has done. And then in one of the great moments in Western history, Nathan the prophet looks King David in the eyes and says, you are the man. You are the man. Incredible story. Now, why did Nathan the prophet have the nerve, the courage, to confront the king in this way, that you're the one who stole the wife from someone else and so on? He had the courage to do that because he knew that King David knew that Uriah the Hittite, even as a foreigner, even as a resident alien, stood under the covenant protection of God. Because God now was viewed by the ancient Hebrews as transcendent to the human scene. He wasn't just one of a whole plethora of divinities and spirits warring against each other. God was the creator God and the guarantor of justice. Now that is an incredible moment, just as the change among the Ionian Greek philosophers was an incredible moment in Western history. Because in both cases, by having a reference point or a way of explaining physical and social reality that transcends nature in some sense, or at least moves away from nature simply being caused by the gods and goddesses and spirits. In both cases, you have far-reaching results. In the case of the Ionian philosophers, you begin to put in place the building blocks for the rise of modern science. Incidentally, these kinds of considerations are some of the reasons why I think Jared Diamond in his book Guns, Germs, and Steel is so wide of the mark. I think it's a hugely imaginative book, the one we asked our freshmen to read. It's a fun read. I learned a whole lot from it. I think he's partly right, but he just doesn't believe that ideas are all that important. I think ideas are hugely important in human affairs. The Greeks were off on a new way of understanding nature. The Hebrews, I think, were off on a new way of understanding justice and morality, which also then happened in a different way among the Greeks. I'll detail that a little later because this also stimulates the Greeks in different ways to begin to talk about justice and so on, and we get the Socratic dialogues and the whole development of concerns about how humans relate to each other. But Nathan had, the prophet, had the courage to do it because he knew that King David knew that Uriah the Hittite, even as a resident alien, stood under the covenant protection of God. And this is why within Israel, and later among the Jews, you have this persistent, powerful, far-reaching concern for justice. I'll elaborate on this a little later. These two strands of Western culture are extraordinarily important. For reasons I'll detail later, the Greeks began to talk about justice too, and they began to talk more in terms of knowing what is right and just and good. The Hebrews, for a whole range of interesting reasons, did not think you really had justice until you did justice. They weren't so interested just in knowing what was right and just, but in doing it. The whole phrase, doing the truth, which was very fundamental to Judaism, was in some ways rather more foreign to the Greek philosophers. But these two ways of thinking balanced each other and became seeds for further development as
Judaism and Christianity interacted with Greek culture. The persistent, pervasive, powerful concern of Jews for justice. And the focus of the Greeks on rational reflection, on delineating ever more clearly what justice was and what it might mean to act fairly and so on, among competing claims that people have. This desacralizing of nature or demythologizing of nature unleashed enormous creativity, but it was also a dangerous revolution. Because once you begin to objectify nature in the way the Ionian philosophers did, or to see nature as quite distinct from divinity, it seems to me you open up the constant danger of brutalizing nature. As long as nature was personal and the spirits and the gods and the goddesses pervaded nature, you had to be rather careful because you were going to offend somebody. You were going to step on their toes and they were going to strike back at you. But once you begin to explain nature in terms of earth, air, fire, and water, or once you begin to understand nature as the creation of a transcendent God, it at least becomes more likely, more possible, that you can treat nature badly. I'm going to expand on this a little bit later when we look at some of the Genesis material. I think Genesis, as I'll argue, has been very widely misinterpreted because humans are not just to subdue nature but also to be caretakers and stewards. And again, I'll point to the fact that I think human dominion over nature is not, first of all, a moral reality, it's an empirical fact. That to be human means you're going to have power over nature. What I'd like to do for, I think it's about 8 or 10 minutes, I just last night serendipitously turned on one of the Mars Hill tapes. It's a series of tapes discussing current ideas and on a broad range of issues, and I like to play them sometimes in the evening when I do my exercises because it makes it a little less boring. And the tape was some commentary and an interview with English philosopher Mary Midgley. We actually, for a number of semesters, used one of her books in the course. And it touches, in part, on exactly what we've been talking about, some of the problems of reductionism and some of the relations between science and the humanities. And so I'm going to take about 8 minutes to play this and then make a few concluding comments and possibly have a little discussion. I think we've got it at the right place now, if you can. Reductionism, it was quite relevant to what we've been talking about this morning, and I just wanted to share it. I think it raised some extraordinarily interesting questions. Let me pause just for a moment here and see if you have any questions or reactions from where we've gone so far. We've covered a range of materials, but what I've really tried to do is give you a little sense of the history of ideas of some of the extraordinarily interesting things that have shaped our modern understanding of nature, and also to get you thinking just a little bit that having nature pervaded with spirit in gods and goddesses and having it utterly personal is not an unmitigated advantage. It can make life very, very difficult. We tend to look somewhat nostalgically back to some earlier period where people were, quote, in tune with nature, some golden age, some South Sea Island paradise. But I think as cultural historians and anthropologists and others have been more
honest in a sense and have tried as hard as they can to describe reality, such situations probably were fairly rare. A great deal of so-called primitive life was pretty hard. People were killing and fighting and disease was rampant, and it was not necessarily the kind of paradise that we think of. People often lived with a great deal of fear. And I thought just touching briefly on these ideas would open up some possibilities, and also would help us understand that this desacralizing of nature is potentially very, very dangerous. I think it truly is a possibility that we will destroy ourselves because we've now have this habit of objectifying nature, and we have such incredible power over it. But let me stop. Are there any reactions that you had or questions that that come up? Everything crystal clear. Greg, you want to add any thoughts, or Bob or Jamie?
Often play into maybe even subconsciously without saying it directly, play into the way we therefore think about what's reasonable and how we should view the world. We have these bad examples in the past.
Sure. Sure. We're going to touch actually on this a little bit later, because I think what happens in the history of Western thought is that the Enlightenment and the focus on human reason becomes a kind of God surrogate. Religion gets us into so many arguments. There are these religious wars. There's all this tension. Wouldn't it be great if we could bracket that and confine it more to the personal realm, and then use human reason as the way of talking about public philosophy, social ethics, political theory, and so on. And this unleashed a huge amount of creativity in Western culture. I think reason began to function almost in a godlike way. We live in an age where much of this is now being questioned. The whole postmodernist critique suggests that human reason can't deliver all that it promised, and that human reason is fallible too. The other thing, I think, Greg, that changes the climate a lot, and why I think we are in the midst of rethinking this, is that we've just concluded a century in which many, many more people were killed, maimed, and tortured by secular philosophies than ever happened in the name of religion. And so I think people have begun to realize that it's not just religion that can produce controversy and difficulty, but any philosophy, whether it's secular or religious, that pretends or tries to answer the big questions can do the same thing. So we've seen a century where maybe 50 to 100 million people were killed in the name of secular belief, which totally dwarfs the number that were killed and maimed in the preceding 20 centuries in the name of religion. So it's a very complex issue. Yes?
Do you think that those high numbers are due to more technology or secular?
I would say due to both, really. I think there was something in the utilitarian mode of Marxism that was particularly lent itself to exploiting people, whereas I think that religious thinking in the West has been more hesitant at that point. It never embraced utilitarianism in the same way. So I think a lot of this had to do with the nature of Marxism, and then in Nazi Germany had to do with the kind of strange combination of religious and secular. Nazism was sort of a pagan resurgence of almost nature worship, plus Hegel and Nietzsche and so on, a more secular philosophy. So I think it's some of both. Yes? Mm-hmm. Leo?
Right.
Right.
And according to the definition that we're discussing then, I don't think you can show me a single mass murder during World War II, World War I, or any other event that's happened last century that's not religion.
Oh, exactly. Leo, thank you very much. You're precisely right. Now, I didn't make that point right now because the view that I hold of a functional view of religion, that Marxism was essentially religious, a kind of, quote, scientific religion, as the Marxists wanted to call it, I think that point's exactly right. So all of this is, you could think of as a form of ideology or different forms of religion. I think that's, in some ways, a more adequate way of putting it. But then, the corollary of that is that every human being is religious. The corollary is that any time you ask the big questions, who am I and how should I live and what should I do, you are asking, quote, a religious question. And there's secular religion, a la Marxism or humanism, and there's supernatural religion, a la Judaism and Christianity, and then there are also sort of humanistic religions like Taoism and Confucianism and so on. So I think your point is exactly right. That's precisely what I meant to say, is that when these global ideologies function in that way, they really do function like religion. Excellent point. Yeah. Good. I think our time is up. Thank you.